Welcome to a Neon Jazz interview with the New York-based jazz alto saxophonist and composer, Rudresh Mahanthappa. Born in Italy and raised in Boulder, Colorado, with Indian roots, he has an impressive jazz sound and just released an ode to one of his favorite jazz cats, our very own Charlie Parker here in KC, on his latest album, Bird Calls. Rudresh is a refreshing, intelligent, and gifted musician that is one of the most in-demand players in the jazz world today, and he has big plans for the future. Dig this interview, my friends.
First of all, thank you very much for taking a little time out for us here at Neon Jazz. We really appreciate it.
Oh, sure, definitely.
What I want to do is obviously talk about one of the most pressing things I'm sure going on with you right now, which is Bird Calls. And talk to me a little bit about the creative energy that went into this release.
Well, you know, Charlie Parker is a huge influence on what I do and was my major inspiration to, you know, to make a life in jazz. So, yeah, a lot of my albums and a lot of my work in recent years has heavily showcased and portrayed my Indian heritage and has been an expression of my Indian-American identity. And a lot of different forays to different degrees of seeing how non-Western and Western music can be unified into, you know, a single statement of sorts. And you know, avoiding real notions of cut-and-paste fusion and trying to create some music that defies genre. But with Bird Calls, I really wanted to take a step back and look at my roots as a jazz musician. And, you know, and all along, regardless of the music I've composed and recorded, you know, I consider myself a jazz musician first and foremost. And it was just a really exciting endeavor to go back and re-examine Charlie Parker after all this time and, you know, all this other knowledge that I've amassed and all these other experiences and look at what made me want to play music when I was in really, like, you know, sixth or seventh grade.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have a very rich mosaic of geography in your life. You were born in Italy, and then you grew up in Colorado. And then you made your way to New York, went to DePaul before that. So kind of talk to me, you have any formative memories of being in Italy since you were born there?
No, you know, my father was on sabbatical. So after I was born, I think he had, you know, 3 or 4 months left in the sabbatical. So we, you know, I have no memories of Italy. I did finally make it back to, I was born in Trieste, and I did finally make it back there a few years ago, which was great. You know, I found the apartment where my parents lived and the hospital where I was born. But, you know, I don't feel a great, you know, strong tie to Italy, but it's fun. It's a fun idea. It's a fun little notion. And Trieste is very unique too, because it's, you know, it's part of Italy, but at some point was, you know, more part of what is now Slovenia, and it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So they have very mixed up food and mixed up art and mixed up architecture that's kind of Italian but kind of Austro-Hungarian, and you know, definitely a hybrid sort of system going on there, which relate to, obviously.
Well, no, that sounds like they're confused in the right way. Where is that geographically in Italy?
It's practically on the border of Slovenia. It's like in the far northeast.
Interesting. Yeah, I have my family, half of my family came from Naples and the other half came from Sciacca. And I've been fortunate enough to get to the old country a couple times. And I would have to say, to have a birth calling card from there would be a pretty cool notion, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
So let me ask you this. What has been your the reception to your jazz music in India? How do they think about jazz?
Well, you know, I haven't played in India that often. So, you know, I mean, the last time I performed there was in 98. And since then, you know, albums that I've made, like Kinsmen, which, you know, featured the Carnatic superstar Kadri Gopalnath, and I made an album called Apti that features a trio of mine with tabla and guitar. And those albums have, you know, made it somehow to India. And I think there's there is some interest in what I do. But, you know, these ideas of that idea of hybridity that, you know, that, that comes through my music with, you know, this synthesis of Indian ideas and American ideas. I mean, that's truly an American concept. And so I think it's a little bit lost on Indian music fans. I mean, I think they can appreciate the music for what it is and hopefully enjoy it. But I don't think they necessarily relate to that base of experience. Because, you know, I mean, India is not a country of immigrants by any means. And
right.
So I think there's something unique to the Western world, to, you know, Europe and North America that just the point of relation to that experience is different. I mean, jazz in India is an interesting thing. I mean, I think there is space for, you know, this new generation of, you know, people like myself and Reza Bassi and Vijay Iyer. I mean, I think there is an audience there that we have not tapped into, but that doesn't necessarily care that what we're doing is jazz, but it's music that they could relate to. As far as jazz goes, I mean, there is this older crowd of, you know, a more cosmopolitan, westernized crowd that does try to actually, you know, present concerts. And, you know, these guys have these amazing record collections, and, you know, they have everything that Monk recorded and everything that Coltrane recorded. I mean, and they're incredibly well listened and diligent supporters of the music. So, but it's funny that you asked that, because we are trying to go, not with Bird Calls, but my previous project, Gamak, we're trying to get to India this fall to play some of those newer jazz festivals that have started recently, and hopefully do some other things that are just maybe outside of the jazz vein, and where we can actually reach some people we otherwise wouldn't.
Absolutely. So talk to me a little bit about the influence of the Indian saxophonist Kadri on you. Like, as far as what kind of mentor and what kind of wisdom did he impart on you to approach jazz and life with the way that he did things?
Well, I think the relationship with Kadri is very interesting. I mean, he's a really good friend, and he has conducted himself as an Indian musician much more like a jazz musician, which I have great respect for. You know, he brought this instrument that no one was playing within any sort of Indian classical circles, the saxophone, because he just fell in love with the sound after having, you know, heard the saxophone in some of these British palace bands when he was young. And very much, you know, made sure that he did, you know, all his homework as a classical Indian musician, and that he could do anything on his instrument that any other musician could do, whether they're a vocalist or, you know, a violinist or, you know, one of these double reed players, like a Nadaswaram player. And he also doesn't come from this, you know, there's this sense of lineage. There's this importance placed on lineage in Indian music, that you studied with so-and-so, or that you're the child of so-and-so, and everyone in your family has played this instrument going seven generations back. And, you know, and he doesn't have any of that, you know. So in that way, he has a sort of renegade mentality that, you know, that maybe someone like Charlie Parker had, you know, that's hearing something in their head and is going to do their damnedest to get it out into the world. And then for me personally, you know, I've been listening to a lot of Indian music, you know, if we go back to, say, the early 90s, you know, when I was in college, and I was dealing with it the same way I was dealing with jazz. I was trying to learn as much by ear as possible and try to play along with records the same way I was with, you know, Coltrane records or whoever. And, but, you know, the very difficult thing was, you know, with these vocalists and violinists and especially these string instruments, you know, there's this complex system of ornamentation called gamaka in Indian music that is very difficult to convey on the saxophone for technical reasons. You know, we can't slide around the way a string player or a vocalist can. And so I felt like I was missing a lot of the detail, or I was kind of, you know, abbreviating some of the stuff because I didn't really know how to go about making it happen. And so when I finally got my hands on one of Guthrie's CDs, and at the time it was his only recording available outside of India, you know, and we're talking pre-internet, we're talking, you know, 1991, 1992 or something. You know, the eye-opening thing was that I could actually hear how he was doing these things on the saxophone, and I could actually pick it apart technically in addition to musically. So that was, you know, that was an eye-opening experience. And then, you know, fast forward a few years later, he was playing a concert in the U.S. in Boston. I went backstage and talked to him, and he was just blown away that there was an Indian-American jazz musician, jazz alto saxophonist. I mean, he didn't know that one even existed. And on top of that, you know, my parents and, you know, my ancestry, my parents and him are, you know, from a similar part of India. And he also really liked my name. My name has kind of powerful meaning and in its Sanskrit roots. So I gave him the CD that I had on hand at the time, which I think was maybe Black Water. What, it was either my first or second CD. And to this day, I don't know if he ever opened it and listened to it, but I think he liked my energy and he liked my vibe, and we just kind of hit it off immediately. And, you know, and then a few years later, there were several opportunities that opened up for us to collaborate. And that was great. I mean, for me, that was, you know, being in the room with him working on music is probably as close as I will come to, you know, having been able to be in the same room as Bird or Coltrane.
Right on. That's cool. So you grew up in Boulder, Colorado. Was there something about Boulder that really fostered a love and an appreciation for jazz?
I think there's something about Boulder that, I haven't lived there in years, so I don't know if it's still the case, but there is something very open-minded and open-ended about Boulder. I mean, even the school system at the time, you know, if you showed interest in something, the school would find a way for, you know, you to pursue that. You know, if you were really good in math, they would connect you with a professor at the university, and you know, you'd be able to miss school one afternoon to go work with a professor or something like that. So it was a very encouraging environment, period. And that was before all of the, you know, the budget cuts that have happened over the last 20 years. And we had a great band program from instrumental music from fourth grade all the way through high school was incredibly strong. I mean, my high school had 2 jazz bands, 1 orchestra, 1 concert band, 1 marching band, and 12 choirs.
Wow.
I mean, it was, you know, we had a lot of music. I mean, music was like one whole wing of the school, and the facilities were amazing too. And, you know, and I showed some gumption to want to try to write music and lead a band. And so I, you know, started a little trio or a quartet, and the school very much got behind that and gave us time to work on that. And, you know, sent us to festivals and competitions. And, but, you know, on top of that, I had an amazing teacher from the very beginning all the way until I went to college. So, and he's a very good, well-respected musician in the Denver metro community. His name is Mark Harris. And Mark just, I think I was probably his first student or one of his first students ever. I think he was a sophomore or a junior at University of Colorado, and I was in fourth grade. And he, you know, one of the major things he, you know, imparted in me was just a sense of individuality and unique personality and, you know, being yourself and following your gut and, you know, learning as much as you possibly can, but always trying to maintain a unique voice. And we didn't label a lot of music either. I mean, he would come over for my lessons. That was when a teacher used to come to your house. I don't know if those days still exist, but he came over and, you know, he would always bring 3 or 4 LPs with him, and they'd always be different, and he'd loan them to me for the week. And, you know, it might be Stravinsky and Gentle Giants and Sidney Bechet and Duke Ellington. And,
cool.
You know, and I would listen to these things over the course of the week, and I was listening to these things all at the same time. So I didn't really, I didn't draw like incredible boundaries of, you know, of genre and style. I mean, all these things existed in the same continuum for me. So, you know, and then maybe on the jazz end of things, you know, I didn't really think about Bird and Ornette and Louis Armstrong and, you know, Sidney Bechet being different from each other. I just, they all existed. They all inhabited the same space for me. So it really wasn't until I went to college where people were talking about hard bop. I mean, obviously bebop, of course, but people were talking about hard bop and avant-garde and this guy plays outside and this guy plays inside. And it's like, what is, you know, what is this? You know, Ornette sounds like Bird to me. And, you know, and, you know, Berlioz sounds like Sonny Stitt. Like these are, all these things are in the, inhabiting the same part of my world. So, so that was probably the greatest thing that, that, you know, the greatest gift that he gave me. And he very much lived that as well. Every time I went to see him play, he was playing with a different sort of group. One day it would be an Afropop band. Another day it might be a big band. Another day, it might be a duo with drums. And then another day it was like a progressive rock band. And so he had this very diverse palette himself. And so, having a role model like that from such a young age was, you know, really made all the difference. And I try to do the same thing when I'm teaching as well.
Right on. So you got degrees from the Berklee College of Music in DePaul. What did you learn about jazz in those institutions getting those degrees?
Well, I mean, it was different. I mean, I think a lot of school, I mean, I think 50% of school or even less is, you know, is the coursework. It's more about finding the right teachers that happen to be at these schools and being in a creative environment, hopefully with some like-minded students. So the two things that were important to me to do at Berklee, you know, the reasons I went there, one was to study with Joe Viola. Joe Viola was a legendary saxophone teacher, not necessarily a jazz teacher, but just a saxophone teacher, just the mechanics of playing the instrument. And was really kind of the last of his kind, you know, the kind of a direct descendant of the French Conservatory School, which is, you know, kind of the preeminent school as to how to play the saxophone.
Yeah.
So that was important to me. And then, and George Garzon was teaching there as well. And George was someone, you know, I really liked his playing. I liked his spirit. I liked his, you know, he was definitely had a unique sound, but was, you know, kind of simultaneously based in Stan Getz and Coltrane. And again, one of these guys who has checked out a lot of things and created his own space. So those were my two biggest directives going to Berklee. And then along the way, I think, you know, the really important thing was meeting some like-minded students and working on ideas and concepts together and really playing, you know, putting together jam sessions and playing till, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning every night. You know, that was much more important than the coursework. And there were a couple of other teachers there that were really impactful. But it's more about finding this environment than finding a school that's going to spoon feed you what jazz is supposed to be or what jazz is. You know, it's like, and in that sense, you don't necessarily need to go to school. I mean, I think the degrees are fine if you'd like to pursue, you know, academia at some point. But I think you can achieve some of those things just by, you know, moving to a creative environment. I mean, there are plenty of people, at least not so much anymore, but back in the day there were people that just, you know, they moved to New York to play music and New York was school. DePaul was an interesting situation. You know, a lot of my classmates at Berklee were moving to New York, and it was almost like there was this prescribed template that, you know, you go to Berklee and then you move to New York, and you don't really question that. You don't think about, well, does that really sound like a good idea? You know, am I going to be able to eat and pay my rent? You know, I didn't really like New York. I had visited a few times. I thought it was very overwhelming. And I had a couple of friends in Chicago that said, well, you know, the scene is very healthy here, and, you know, why don't you come check it out? And one of them was a student at DePaul. So I went out there and stayed with him. And not only did I check out the school, but I really, you know, checked out the scene. I went to every jam session. I went to every club and, you know, just kind of scoped out what the possibilities were like there. And then there was this very bizarre coincidence where one of my ensemble directors at Berkeley, his best man at his wedding was the director of the jazz studies program at DePaul. So he made a couple of phone calls for me. And so that transition was very easy. And when I was there, I wasn't really interested in performance, a performance degree. I'd already studied with Joe and George, and I was more interested in composition and arranging. And there was a really great teacher there named Paul McKee, who, and again, it was very open-ended, which was the best way for me to learn, and has always been the best way for me to learn. So he kind of let me do whatever I wanted. I said, well, I'm going to try to write, a big band chart. And he said, okay, well, go work on it, come back, and then we'll talk about it. And actually, a lot of the music I wrote during that degree ended up being the music for my first album. So that was a really beneficial place. And then I stayed in Chicago for a couple of years after and just worked and played. I was teaching at a couple of universities and playing as many gigs as I could and writing more music. But to do what I really wanted to do, I knew that I had to move to New York. It actually boiled down to one very easy question. I said, well, I would like to play with Jack DeJohnette and Dave Holland someday. And is that ever going to happen if I stay in Chicago? And I think the answer was clearly no. So I left and just kind of moved on.
So you make it to the Mecca, you make it to New York, and you hook up with Vijay Iyer. That had to be one hell of a jazz baptismal right there.
Well, actually, I mean, that's interesting. Vijay and I met, had already been doing stuff before I moved to New York. People often think that that happened in New York, but that actually happened earlier. That happened maybe in 95, like a couple of years before, because at that time, Steve Coleman, the great alto saxophonist, who has also been a very big influence on me, he didn't really do that much teaching. He's doing a lot of teaching, kind of seminar, workshop-oriented things now. But at that time, he wasn't really doing much of that. But there was this rare instance that he was teaching at the Stanford Jazz Workshop in California. So I got wind of that, and I was like, wow, this is, kind of a unique opportunity to ideally, hopefully, hang out with Steve for a week and pick his brain. Yeah. And so I went out there that summer, and Vijay had just recorded his very first album, and Steve had played on a few tracks, and additionally, Steve had led a larger group called the Mystic Rhythm Society that had, I think, had two piano players in it, and one of them was Vijay. Steve had really tapped into the Bay Area music scene. He'd spent a month out there with the Five Elements with this idea of meeting a bunch of local musicians in the Bay Area and collaborating with them. So that's how he and Vijay met. So Steve was actually the one who introduced us. I remember at the beginning of the workshop, Steve kept talking about somebody named Vijay who played piano. And I was thinking it was someone's initials that were Vijay. And then finally I was like, is this guy Indian? He said, yeah. I said, is his name Vijay? He said, yeah, that's how you say it. And I was very flattered when Steve introduced us. Steve was like, yeah, Vijay, I'd love to play on your gigs. You have this new album out, but, if I can't make it, you should call this guy. So that's how that started. So,
cool.
Vijay and I hung out. We didn't really do much playing, but we hung out one night, stayed up pretty late and kind of talked about life and our backgrounds and realized that we had so many things in common that had nothing to do with music. But on top of that, not only were we pursuing improvised music, but we were pursuing it along similar lines with similar interests. And we obviously, both of us really liked Steve Coleman,
Yeah.
So we kept in touch over the course of the year, and my first album came out, and his first album came out, and he managed to get a gig for us at this South Asian Arts and Activism Festival in Toronto. He got us a duo gig, and you know, we still hadn't played together. So we sent each other a bunch of music, and we got there 3 days ahead of time and rehearsed like crazy. And we've been playing together ever since. I think we're, I can't remember if it's going to be 19 years or 20 years this year.
Wow. Right on. So in all of the albums, 12 plus, that you've released, do you think Bird Calls is one of your most important pieces of work?
That's funny. I mean, I think we always think the last thing we did is one of our most important pieces of work. But I think, yes, I will say yes. I think, I mean, for me, it's nice to... it's nice for me to show people that I'm a jazz musician, and I don't think anyone has lost sight of that necessarily, but, you know, so much of what I've done, you know, since, say, you know, 2008 or something has been very much oriented towards, you know, my perspectives on, you know, what global culture is and what global music can be, and all of that is so much, you know, woven into the fabric of what I do. I mean, I think it comes out regardless of what I do, whether I'm deliberately or not. So to check back in with Charlie Parker is definitely very important to me. And I think it's, you know, it also shines a light on, you know, this important historical figure that who remains very relevant now, and showing that his relevancy is and his impact is timeless, I think it's very important, and shows a strong sense of, you know, the historical nature of this music, and that, you know, everyone has to really thank Charlie Parker. If anyone who's playing music today at some point has to thank Charlie Parker, because he really did make many things possible.
Absolutely. So let me ask you this. If you could get into that Star Trek chamber and go back in time and meet anybody in the world of jazz, who would it be and what would you want to talk to them about?
I think, well, I mean, I think, I think, you know, Charlie Parker would definitely be up there. I mean, I would also like to meet Coltrane. I remember reading this quote that I really liked. It was on the back of one of the first Bird albums I ever had. And I didn't really understand it at the time. And it just struck me again. I think Charlie Parker met Jean-Paul Sartre.
Uh-huh.
And he told him, he said, "I like the way you play very much." And I just thought that was really, really cool. And, kind of speaks to what, you know, artistic expression can be, or, you know, or what it is, you know, how, you know, this idea of medium and genre, maybe, you know, these are lines that, you know, we've drawn maybe too heavily in the sand here. So I almost feel like I would love to meet Charlie Parker, but I'm not sure I would necessarily want to talk to him about music. You know, I would like to talk to him about life and food and art, or, you know, if I could bring Charlie Parker into the present, I would, you know, love to take him to the Museum of Modern Art in New York and just look at art together.
That'd be cool.
Yeah.
That'd be very cool. Yeah, that's great. So let me ask you this. What's the greatest thing about waking up every day?
The greatest thing about waking up every day is seeing my son.
Cool.
Yeah, we have a 2-year-old. He was born in December 2012, and he is just a joy. You know, I'm talking to you right now. I'm on the road. I'm in Cleveland, and you know, I definitely miss him, especially when I wake up, because
yeah.
he is just so much fun and such an inspiration, and I feel like I'm just relearning and re-examining so many things about life through his eyes and his perspective.
That's beautiful. Very cool. So you're one of the favorites in Downbeat. You're one of the favorites in the modern jazz realm at this point. Tell me what, you know, it's not the goal I know of any musician to get hardware and awards, but is there one award that you got that you're like, man, that's cool?
Yeah, I think there are a couple. Well, it's funny, I think I had to preface this. So, you know, I remember that, you know, there was a time you know, we're maybe jazz had a different place in the industry. But I remember seeing those critics polls and readers polls when I was in high school and college, and at kind of simultaneously, I very much wanted to be on those, and at, you know, at the same time, couldn't even imagine being on those. You know? And the first time I ever made it onto, and this is just kind of a weird story, but I think it shows some reality of the situation. But the first time I ever just made it onto the Downbeat Readers Poll, you know, like pretty far down there, maybe number 7 or number 11 or something like that. I remember I was so broke I had to borrow $5 from my girlfriend to go buy the copy at Barnes & Noble. So you know, that kind of put some of it in perspective. Yeah. And I think there was a time that, what you know, when if you were topping these polls, that actually led to gigs, that led to work. That was like a real form of promotion. And I, you know, it may remain that to some degree, but it's nothing like it was, say, in the 80s or maybe even in the 90s. So, but the recognition is great, and those guys at Downbeat are great. I'm so honored to, you know, for all these people to be fans of what I do and see it as being important. I think getting the Guggenheim Fellowship was a really big one for me, because it was really in the realm of being a composer, and not necessarily in the context of jazz, but speaking to music composition in general. And, you know, the people who have received the Guggenheim for music composition are some of the greatest composers that have ever lived. So,
absolutely.
You know, to inhabit that world for a little while is really an honor, I think. And of course, you know, there was this Doris Duke Performing Arts Award that I got a couple of years ago that, it was specifically for jazz. I mean, Doris Duke was a huge jazz fan, and that foundation has been a really ardent supporter of jazz in general in the U.S. And that was a really amazing award too, and really something that was, not only life changing with regard to the recognition, but the actual, you know, the size of the award was actually life changing too. And, you know, has allowed us to, you know, better our home situation as well. So that was really great also.
Right on. So is the home that brought Charlie Parker the world here in Kansas City, do you have any plans of bringing the Bird Talks here and playing it?
I would love to. We have not pursued that, but I would love to pursue that. I think, you know, if I remember correctly, just the Jazz Museum is there, correct?
Yeah, the American Jazz Museum is there, yes.
Yeah, and I was talking with them a number of years ago about doing something there. I don't know how much they're presenting in the way of concerts, but I think I need to, you know, revisit that conversation and see if we could get there. I think it would be a real shame if this project did not get to Kansas City.
Yeah, that'd be beautiful. We would love, we'd have open arms. Let me get kind of an idea of who you are a little bit. Tell me, what's the last vinyl you spun, vinyl album?
Oh, gosh. The last vinyl album I spun was probably Dire Straits' Brothers in Arms.
Nice. Very nice. very nice. And let me ask you this. Let's say in 10 years we talk and we catch up with what's going on. What are you going to be happy to tell me happen? What are you really wanting to see happen maybe in the next decade as your career goes forward?
Oh, that's interesting. Hopefully I'll be happy to tell you that I have an academic position that is allowing me to, you know, pass what I know on to some other people in a more sort of formal structure, you know, hopefully I'll have at least another 5 albums out, and
cool.
And we'll be pursuing more that's outside of jazz. You know, I'm in Cleveland because I wrote a big piece for a dance company, and we are and the band plays live with them, and it's a really great collaboration. I'm looking forward to doing more things that are interdisciplinary like that. Yeah, And maybe I'll be telling you about a Grammy. Who knows?
Right on. That's cool, man. What do you think there, if someone reads your bio, you know, people that read up on you and look into your music after they hear you, what piece about you does the world not know about that you think would be safe to tell me right now, that people just don't know about you?
That I watch a lot of TV.
Cool. Very cool. And then final question, if you had to sum up who you are in the length of a tweet, our 21st century friend, how would you sum yourself up?
Saxophonist, citizen of the world, loving father, devoted husband.
Right on. That's a great way to end right there. Hey, Rudresh, I really appreciate your time. I love your music. I'm going to spin it healthily on my show.
Oh, thank you. It was great to talk to you, too.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York City, Kansas City, spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Rudresh for his time and insights. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino on the iTunes Store or visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.